Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Medical Minds Conversations with Guthrie Experts. I'm Steve Ostrous, joined as always by co-host Dr. Corinne Johnston, who is a family medicine physician, as well as the Chief Patient Experience Officer for the Guthrie Health Clinic. Hello, Dr. Johnston.
Hey there, Steve. How you doing?
I am doing well, and I'm really excited to talk about this particular topic and learn more about it. We're going to get right to it, OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder. And the reason it came to mind and we decided to do this topic, saw a commercial for something called NoCD, which is something that's being promoted right now by Howie Mandel. And he, for those who don't know, is a well-known comedian, also one of the judges on America's Got Talent and so on and so forth. And he's been fairly open about his struggles with OCD. So I was wondering, I just don't think it's talked about very much.
Yeah, I think you're right, Steve. Or we talk about it in generalities, right? We'll have people say, oh, that's my OCD kicking in. Or you know, in my office, a patient might say, I think I might have OCD. But I'm excited to talk a little bit more about what is true OCD, right? Because a very small percentage of the population has it. I looked it up this morning, about 1.2%, right? And so really, what's a true compulsion? A true compulsion is irresistible. It's against all conscious wishes. We don't want to do it, but it comes out. We can't suppress it. So I think a great topic for those that suffer from this, and awareness for the rest of us when we maybe observe some of their behaviors.
You were talking about saying, oh, that's my OCD kicking in. You know, in doing some research for this episode as well, I was finding how many different celebrities out there, people very well known to our listeners and viewers, who have been public about their struggles currently or in the past when they were younger, and treatment they've received for OCD. And the list is wide ranging. Everyone from Ariana Grande, who is obviously out there right now with Wicked, Howie Mandel, who we already talked about, Lena Dunham from the show Girls, Howard Stern, Daniel Radcliffe, well known as Harry Potter.
Harry Potter,
You know, and all the different struggles. And I think it's important to bring those names up so that people listening to this will understand that they're not alone if they are struggling with OCD, and that some incredibly famous people are feeling the same things they are, perhaps. So there are ways to move forward and hopefully look to others for help and some acknowledgement that there are people just like them.
I agree with you. I think very important, and excited to welcome our guest today.
All right. And speaking of our guest, we're really excited to have Dr. Elena Zaff on to join us. And she is a clinical psychologist with the Guthrie Health System. So Dr. Zaff, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess importantly, it's probably good to start at the beginning. And I know this is probably a very long answer, but if you could talk about OCD and what OCD is for the general person who doesn't understand it, because we were talking earlier before you hopped on about how people become kind of annoyed or angry or frustrated when people say, oh, that's just my OCD kicking in. And there's so much more to it than that. So if you could talk a little bit about what OCD really is.
Absolutely. And so I think one of the things that's important to think about this from that perspective is that it's almost a spectrum. So there is a wide variety of types of obsessions, types of compulsions, and the severity can really be drastically different. So people can have OCD tendencies, but not meet criteria for an actual diagnosis of OCD. So I think what the colloquial term of like, I have OCD or that's my OCD that comes up, I think it tends to be more of those tendencies rather than an actual true diagnostic OCD. Not to say that that's not the case, that it couldn't be diagnostic, but I think that tends to be used in that way as well, rather than just the diagnosis. So from that perspective, there's a couple of things that are important to kind of consider. So this actually used to be considered an anxiety disorder. So in the DSM, which is our manual we use for diagnosing mental health disorders, it used to be actually under anxiety, but they now with the most recent version separated it out to its own class of disorders. So it is now in its own class. It requires the presence of obsessions, compulsions, or both. So it's not even that you necessarily have to have both obsessions and compulsions. You need to have one or the other and meet the criteria within those areas, or you can have both. So if we talk more about the obsessions, I think of this more as like the thought process. So this is the ruminating. This is the stuckness that we talk about when it comes to OCD. So you'll probably hear me mention stuck and stuckness throughout this. And it's that thought that I can't let it go. No matter how hard I try, no matter what I'm doing to try to distract myself, my brain will not let it go. So in terms of the actual definition, they talk about it being recurrent, persistent thoughts, urges or images that at some time cause some sort of disturbance. They're intrusive, they're unwanted. So those are all very important things. It's not like I'm consciously trying to think about this. It's these are things we don't want to be thinking about. And then they cause some level of anxiety or distress. So then the other part of that is it also has to be that if they're attempting to ignore them or suppress them. So they're like, I'm trying to distract myself or I'm trying to think of something else and they can't, that becomes a true obsession. If they are able to almost always neutralize them, get rid of them without doing anything else, if they're just purely distracting themselves or changing their thought process, then that's less of a true obsession. When we get more into the compulsions, it's a similar kind of thing, only these are generally more actions, but they can also be a mental action, which makes it a little bit tricky. So like counting, that's more of a mental action, but it's still an action. So these are repetitive behaviors. So in terms of, I know you were kind of talking about prevalence, in terms of the most common obsession falls in the contamination realm. The most common compulsions fall into washing, which makes sense if the most common one's contamination. And the other one would be checking. So like checking things like, did I lock the door? Did I turn the stove off? Did I unplug my, you know, hair dryer, my electronic, those kind of things. And so when we look at these repetitive behaviors, they are driven to perform these in response to their obsession. So they have this obsession, and then there is very often some sort of fear that is not based in reality. It's like, I'm going to burn the house down, even though in reality, I checked it 4 times and I know that it's unplugged. There's still this fear that's driving, nope, got to check it again. So things like that will kind of perpetuate the behaviors. So then when you get into the second part of the compulsions, it is the fact that when they're trying to prevent or reduce distress, they're doing this behavior to do so. So they are trying to say, I'm going to compensate for this obsessive thought by doing this compulsive behavior so that I can let go of that thought. So it actually reduces some anxiety and distress, which is why it perpetuates and it reinforces that compulsive behavior.
There's a lot to unpack there. So, right. So, you know, you mentioned checking and you said sometimes there's counting. Like, what do you mean specifically when you say counting?
So counting can be a variety of different things. Most common would be like if they're flicking the light switch 3 times or they have to, you know, touch something 4 times before they leave a room. So that kind of counting is kind of one thing. The checking can almost involve some counting if they say I have to check it 3 times. So it can kind of start to overlap. So some of these aren't necessarily completely separate. Sometimes they will combine and have multiple compulsions at the same time for one obsession.
Are there, I think of like stressors that we've all had in life, right? That can lead to things. After I had my first baby, I am very type A. So I had a really hard time being home and I counted a lot. Are there specific like ages where we see this present or triggers that folks might see kind of bring this on?
So the most common age is actually adolescence to young adulthood. Mm-hmm. So usually like 16, 18, 20, like before 25 is usually when we see this, that at least there's some sort of symptoms starting. And if you think about it, talking about stress, you know, that's really easy time in life, right? Like it's so easy to be in adolescence and young adulthood, right? Uh-huh. Think of how much change is happening. So you're still adapting to all the physical, hormonal, and all these other changes. Your brain isn't fully developed. So there's still things that you're not fully able to really plan out well that you're struggling with, to think of long term. And then on top of that, you have, okay, now I'm graduating school. Do I go to college? I have to get a real job. I have to move out and live on my own. Do I have a partner that I'm also trying to do similar things? Do we consider having a family? Like, all these huge major changes happen in our life. And, you know, in terms of our lifespan development, that is when the most changes happen. So what do you think those people desire? Control.
Yeah.
And so that is very often when we talk about OCD, the development of this is, it can be in relation to multiple things, and I'll touch on kind of the different factors, but yeah, this desire for control or need for control tends to be one of the biggest. And that can happen in a lot of different ways. So it can be in result of a trauma. It can be just, I'm feeling out of control of my life because there's so many things and so many transitions and changes that I don't have control over. It can be, like you said, just purely stress. So just feeling overwhelmed and out of control in that way. It can also be if there's a, you know, with trauma, a specific event, right? So if there's a car accident that was really traumatic where you had no control, right? Those kind of things, or a sudden loss, or, you know, any of those kind of experiences can really reinforce and drive this. With that being said, it also can lead to other disorders, so that have similar types of symptoms. So really accurately diagnosing, it can be really important too.
So you talked about the compulsion being in response to the obsession, and sometimes, you know, so that there's some sort of thought process where if you act on the compulsion, then you have more control over that obsession, or that you will prevent something bad happening. Could you go into some of the thought processes that go through people's minds about these bad things? And I know, I'm sure it's different for everyone, but what are some of these things? I mean, yes, with the stove being off, you know, oh, am I going to light the house on fire? But are there other types of really intrusive thoughts, you know, whether it's about a family member? Could you go into those?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one other thing that I just want to clarify too, is that you can have them individually, right? So you can have, like I was saying, diagnostically, you can just have the obsessions or just the compulsions. And so in that circumstance, it's just, I feel the need to do these things that I don't really necessarily, I'm not consciously aware of why. So that can also be a thing. But in general, I would say most people I see and work with clinically have both. And so an example would be like, if we go way back in time and we think about when we were kids, right? Does everybody remember like the don't step on a crack or break your mother's back? Like that, mm-hmm. that thing, right? That can be a real obsession and compulsion. That results in a compulsion, right? So the obsession would be, if I step on a crack, something's bad's going to happen to my mom and she's going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. And then the compulsion is, I'm not going to step on cracks. I'm going to make sure I'm consciously aware that I'm not going to do that thing.
So then this is what they're actively fighting through and struggling through all the time.
And the thing is, too, a lot of times they are, when you actually separate the emotion from the rational thinking and they're able to access that rational mind, which usually is not in the moment when they're doing the thing. But when they can say like, no, this isn't realistic. I know that if I step on a crack, it's not actually going to break my mother's back. And I know she's not actually going to get hurt because of that. But I can't stop. I still have to do it because something still tells me if I step on a crack, my mom will be injured. And so that kind of thing, and like I said, that's a very basic, but I feel like also very, you know, understandable thought process of an example. But it can be with anything where you're right. One of the biggest issues is this fear of somebody close to you getting injured, there being some sort of fallout where someone's going to get hurt if I don't do this thing. And whether or not they can access that rational side of their brain also depends on how stuck their thinking is, because they may be at the point, because we talk about one of the specifiers for OCD is about insight. So how much insight do they have into these obsessions and compulsions? So is it like good or fair where they're like able to have that? Yeah, this is probably not realistic. Like this probably doesn't really connect or make sense. Is it more poor or is it completely absent? Are they having delusional beliefs where they're saying like, yes, absolutely. If I step on that crack, somebody will be hurt.
Yeah. And speaking of moms, is there familial, like, is it genetic? If my mom has OCD, am I more likely to have that?
So what they have found is there's so many factors. So if mm-hmm. you are already predisposed, it's kind of like a predisposing factor, but okay. it is not highly heritable. Like, so there's some sort of inheritable traits that can increase your vulnerability to developing OCD, but it is not like a if then situation. Like okay. if my, you know, mom or my grandmother has it, then I will have it. But I know you also brought up about like things like pregnancy. There is, that's a really important one to touch on, because it can present very different in pregnancy, and it can, the way that it manifests can be, it can be very easily misdiagnosed. And so, you know, postpartum, you have high likelihood of developing increased anxiety, increased yeah. depression, increased actually developing OCD, maybe even for the first time, maybe you had predisposing factors and then now all of a sudden feeling out of, talk about feeling out of control, right? Like yeah. postpartum, everything's out of control. You don't decide when you eat. You don't decide when you sleep. You don't decide mm-hmm. when you go to the bathroom. Like, you don't decide anything. Anything. Baby does.
Yep.
So postpartum, you have no control. So like, if you already have any predisposing factors, you have this now additional stressor, complete sense of loss of control in many areas of your life, it's very easy to have something like this develop. And it can become things of like obsessing over the cleanliness of the bottles, or obsessing over like, you know, washing the syringes for medication or the dosing of medication where you're measuring it 5 times before you actually administer it. Mm-hmm. So it can actually manifest in these ways that really become, so it's actually increasing the anxiety because of the time and energy being invested into these behaviors.
So we're talking about this obviously on purpose because we want to bring more awareness. Do you feel that this is a disorder that's not talked about enough? I know of it, obviously. Howie Mandel has been very open about it. And he's been out there as a comedian, America's Got Talent, all those things. So he's been at the forefront, but do you feel like it gets enough attention? Because he was really, until I really did some research, he seems to be one of the few people talking about it.
Yeah. And getting back to kind of like the factors you were saying, because I know you had mentioned like the 1.2, but some studies yeah. say even up to 2% of the population throughout their yeah. lifetime. So like, it's usually like around 1% at a time, but like throughout the lifespan, it's usually about 2% of the population ends up with this diagnosis. So is it a huge, huge, huge population that experiences this, an actual diagnosable level of OCD? No, but it's significant for sure. So I think that the fact that some of the more popular people in our, you know, social environment are coming out and saying like, hey, this is something I struggle with, I think it's important because I think it is increasing the awareness. I will say, like, I have several people who come to me, and for them, this has always been their reality. And they have never even thought about the fact that this could actually be like a diagnosable thing that should be addressed. So I've had several people that I diagnosed for the first time in adulthood, beyond young adulthood. And they have been like, well, yeah, like I always knew I was like OCD, but like never pursued it as like, this is actually very distressing. I didn't realize I spend X number of hours thinking about this every day. I had no idea that it was that severe. And so I have a little analogy I use with people when I am helping them kind of conceptualize that a colleague shared with me, and it's wonderful. So you take a piece of paper or even your hand, right? And you hold it up to your face, touching your nose. How much of the world do you see around you? Almost nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Bare minimum of the edges. And so what the goal is of treatment of OCD, so that's the OCD. It is in your face. It is in the way, it is keeping you distant from being in the present. It is keeping you distant from fully engaging with family and friends and experiences. So the goal of when we start getting into therapy is to start distancing that. So maybe we then go so that now it's out here. So from my eyes, I can see more around it. And eventually it's over here. So now I have it to the side. So I can see almost everything except for this little area. And eventually we can completely set it down. So that's kind of the way that the therapy works. It's never gone. There is no cure for OCD, yeah. but we can make it so that the quality of life is improving and it's less of a hindrance to really enjoying life.
Yeah. Go ahead, Steve.
What do, when you speak with patients or anybody, obviously not specifics, but what is their reaction when they come to the realization that they're not alone. Like you said, many of them not even understanding it was a thing that could be treated.
I would say overall, it tends to be first kind of the shock of I didn't realize how much this was impeding my life. And I think that's a little scary to when they have that realization. It's like, whoa, this has always been my reality. I didn't realize like this was an actual problem, but now I'm starting to see that it could be. But then from there, I think it also gives them the power. And I think it can be a very empowering thing to have a diagnosis, whether it's OCD or any other mental health diagnosis, because then you have this thing that is a part of who you are. It doesn't define us, but it's a piece that now you can have control over, and you can start to say, wait a second, is this causing an issue in my life? If so, what do I want to change? What do I want to do differently in regards to this? And having that name on there says, okay, now I can say, okay, what are the treatments for OCD? How do I address this? Or when you do, so they have a whole bunch of different screening tools for OCD. Some of them are more specific than others. Some of them are more like for the initial diagnosis. Some are more targeted towards monitoring symptoms as you're doing treatment. And then others have a whole bunch of different subscales that look at these different types of compulsions and obsessions to identify what's your target for therapy. What are we working on? What's the big one that's like really the strongest one that is impacting you and inhibiting your life? And so once we've done that, it gives them the power to say like, oh, okay, so if I address this one, that's going to save me all this extra time. I won't be all these different types of behaviors. And so then they can start to really take those steps forward to make the changes that they want to be able to get closer to living the life that they want.
Yeah. And you talk about therapies. So, or therapy obviously is one of those arms of treatment. If you're someone who, you know, feels that you're struggling with this and identifying that, what are some of the things they may see for treatment and timelines? Because I feel like I'm primary care, right? So everything needs fixed today with a pill. So, you know, what are expectations?
Yeah. So one thing I will say is it depends on the level of stuckness. Because like I said, to me, I view this as a spectrum of severity. There are people who there's like one thing that's really stuck. I've had patients where when the environmental stressor changes, they're able to completely resolve it. Almost like directly, like, so it's more about managing it until the stressor is able to be resolved. So that's more of a quicker one, right? So if they're able to say like, I have had a patient who was in a controlling relationship, and when that relationship was ending, so we were working on contamination and all these different things, checking, and we were doing exposure therapy, which I'll talk more to in a second, but we were doing that and we were making some progress. Mm-hmm. The second that the relationship was terminated, the OCD went away. They were able to like be able to feel control and exhibit control in other areas of their life. They didn't need to do those behaviors anymore to feel that sense of control. That can also happen with eating disorders, because eating disorders have a very similar, you know, pattern to them. Because if you think about starting as a baby, right, what's the one thing they control? Whether or not they eat, like, unless you're using a nasogastric tube, like, they don't get to choose. Like, they are the only ones who get to choose whether or not they eat, right? So other than that, that's the one thing you can always control. You can control whether or not you're going to eat it, whether or not you're going to swallow it. You get to control that. And so in terms of continuing with therapy, though, the most common, like, the kind of like the gold standard is a combination of CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. It's a very common technique used with what we call exposure response prevention, or ERP. And so what that means is we expose them to their stressor, to the thing, to what's going to cause that obsessive thoughts, and they want to do their compulsion, and then we're going to tell them they can't. So it is not necessarily a pleasant experience, but there's two ways to do this. So the more common is going to be something we call gradual exposure, and that's going to be where we kind of create this hierarchy. So I'll give an example of, try to think of a good one. So I'll give an example of, and it can be a baby, a dog, anything, right? And so say it's, I think that they are germy and gross, right? So maybe it's this person is like, I'm about to have a baby, but babies are are dirty and gross and they're sticky and they're all the things, right? Huh. You got to deal with all sorts of fluids. So we create a hierarchy. Okay, what fluid scares you the most, right? Which one is it? Is it, yeah. you know, is it the vomit? Is it the feces? Is it the urine? Is it the boogers? Is it the drool? And we take it and we create this hierarchy. Okay, so for you, it's the vomit. Mm-hmm. Then it's the feces. Then it's the urine. Then it's the boogers. Then it's the drool. Okay, so the first one we're going to expose you to is the drool. We're going to expose you to drool. And then once you get to a level, we have a thermometer, a distress thermometer that we use. And once we get to a level that that feels manageable, we step up the hierarchy. And we say, okay, you've exposed yourself enough to the drool that you, that seems manageable. Now we're going to expose you to the boogies. So now we're going to start exposing you to those. And so then you just kind of work your way up the hierarchy. So like we're going to practice and it's not going to be like, oh, you're going to wipe it with your hand, but we're going to say, okay, so first we're going to start with like, we are not going to wash our hands every single time we think we may have touched, or we're going to delay that. Or so there's two kind of approaches. So there's completely preventing.
Yeah.
But also we want to be realistic, right? Especially when it comes to contamination. There are germs in this world. Like people need to wash their hands. We can't tell them, oh, don't ever wash your hands. So we have to be realistic. But then it's also saying, okay, but you're not going to stop, drop everything and go wash your hands. You're going to wait until. So I had a person who would wash their hands or at least use hand sanitizer in between every store that they would go in while out shopping. And I was like, okay, we're going to wait till you get home. You can wash your hands when you get home, but you're going to wait till you get home. So those kind of things. So it's just kind of reducing the behavior to be more reasonable. Mm-hmm. So that's not impeding their life. So the other option is immersive. So the gradual one, we have our hierarchy, we work our way up. It's, and we kind of go at the rate, and this is where a timeline, it really depends on the person. It depends on their level of commitment. It depends on whether you're doing like an in vivo or in vitro type of exposure, because sometimes we can do it in session. Mm-hmm. So there are actual specialized therapists that do exposure response prevention that say it's a fear of driving on the highway. Your therapist rides with you in your car and goes down the highway with you and like talks you through it as you're doing it. So depending on what the fear or the phobia is, depending on the type of provider, like sometimes it's more of that situation. So it kind of depends on a bunch of factors as to how quickly this goes. And then the other option of this immersive is, okay, so you have a fear of claustrophobia. I'm going to lock you in a closet and we're going to talk through it. And it's not going to be fun, but we're going to do it. And your body's going to learn that even without doing your compulsive behavior, you can be okay. And the distress can go down. Mm-hmm.
So either way, right? It's a lot. It sounds like a lot of work, meaningful work to get to that change, but it's not a quick fix generally.
Generally not. And I think it also, like talking about that level of stuckness, it depends. That's a factor, but there are medications that can also help. So I've had some people where we've tried several different behavioral plans and every time week they come back and tell me, I'm like, I didn't do that. And so when we're that stuck and they're like, I think about doing it. I think about trying it, but their level of motivation just isn't quite there. And that can be because just purely they're not ready to change the behavior, but it could also be like, I desperately want to do this thing, but I physically can't. And so when it's that level of stuckness, then that's when I usually kind of work with primary care docs or whoever their prescriber is, say, hey, can we maybe try adding in a medication? So because of the way that this works, it's where there's an actual dysfunction with one of the neuronal loops in the brain. And so because of that, what it impacts is our serotonin levels. So an SSRI, clomipramine is also known for specifically for more stuckness, for more of this, you know, treatment resistant OCD, but those medications can be helpful and used usually in combination with the therapy to be able to get them just over that hump so they can do the exposure. And eventually they can usually get off that medication, but sometimes they find it helpful for long-term to just not create new obsessions or compulsions.
Do you find too that how difficult is it for people to even recognize? And I guess I'm thinking like loved ones, friends, that somebody they know maybe suffering from OCD because it's kind of a hidden disorder, right? That people are going to great lengths to keep it to themselves.
There tends to be a lot of guilt and shame around OCD, especially depending on what it is. So depending on what the actual, you know, behavior or obsession is, there tends to be some guilt and shame because it's different, right? So it's not what a quote unquote normal, you know, person may experience. So yeah, they do tend to hide it. So it does make it hard. I think when it starts impairing their life more is when people start to see it more, which means that sometimes it's really waiting until it gets exacerbated to really be able to externally see it. But people I think that are really close can notice the little things here or there. I think it's just how well that person is hiding and masking it and how comfortable they feel with the individual. And it's not necessarily a, like, I, you know, you're my partner, I don't feel comfortable with you. It can be, well, I feel really embarrassed about this, so I don't feel comfortable sharing it too. So it's not necessarily a direct reflection of the relationship. And I think that's important because sometimes people and partners and stuff will take it personally and be like, why didn't you tell me? Or, you know, I could have helped you, right? And it's not necessarily that, because if it's the guilt and shame, it's, I don't want anyone to know, or I don't want to burden them with what I'm experiencing.
Go ahead, Steve.
No, go ahead,
Dr. Oh, I was going to say, and we might be on the same page here because I know our discussion. So sometimes, like, I think about, like, tics in a child, we say, don't draw attention to it. But this sounds different. So if I'm a loved one and I'm seeing that, what can I do to be supportive, or a friend that's showing those behaviors?
So a lot of times what I would say, you know, clinically, a lot of my patients have reported as being helpful is almost like a level of accountability, where they can say, hey, I'm feeling really anxious about this because this just happened. And then they can say, ooh, okay, I get it. Let's try some of your techniques. Let's try this. Okay, let me help distract you. Let's go talk about something. Let's do something ridiculous. Like, just helping them kind of implement their tools. So whether it's a coping skill, it's a distraction technique, whatever it may be, but help, you know, breathing exercise, grounding, whatever it is, but helping them kind of implement those and just being supportive. I think the other part is validating it. It's like, I see that this thing happened, and I can see that it's really hard for you right now, rather than be like, it's not a big deal. Just get over it. Just move on. Like, just let it go. Right. Those are the phrases that I think we tend to respond with, but for the person, it becomes very minimizing and invalidating of the severity of their experience. And then they're going to be less likely to share about it in the future. So trying to really just validate, and even if it's not how you feel about the thing, being able to say, I see that's really hard for you. I can tell this is really stressing you out. Like, how can I help? Being able to kind of be there in that moment rather than kind of applying our own perspective to that moment can be helpful too.
That's such a great point, because I think we oftentimes search for what to say, right? You know, we know someone lost a loved one. We ask them, how are you doing? Because we don't know what else to say, which is a trigger. So to your point, that ability to validate and say, I see that bothers you, that is great.
You know, obviously, it's been almost, I can't even believe this, 5 years now since COVID. But we talk about contamination and washing. And I have to imagine that COVID has made it extremely difficult for people with OCD who have those tendencies, because now, like you said, we can't just tell people to completely stop washing their hands. And now, obviously, there was a pandemic and people are even more concerned and worried. What were you, are you seeing that even now, 5 years out, because now people are more concerned?
Yeah, I still have patients that will come in and say, oh, well, this got worse during COVID. It also kind of, the isolation that happened around that time, I think also worsened several different aspects of both OCD as well as other aspects of mental health, right? So that isolation, not having that socialization, having more control in our lives because we didn't have to go see people do things that people didn't want to do. You weren't constantly invited to things, yeah. Right? So if they didn't want to, they just could say, oh, nope, COVID. Okay. Where now they have to say no, and they have to come up with, you know, they feel they have to come up with a reason, because in reality, we don't owe anybody an explanation, but people feel that they need to come up with an excuse or a reason, right? And so I think overall, that sense of control shifts. And it shifted quite dramatically in terms of in relation to COVID. And that feeling of helplessness in that situation, I think, really exacerbated lots of different mental health disorders.
We're full of questions. You go because I was going to go just down a little different track.
Oh, okay. Well, I think I may have too. So, you know, you went, you know, so as are anyone dealing with mental health issues. So I guess with somebody in your profession, why did you go down this path? And what is it about this profession that makes you just feel that, you know, I guess you're accomplishing a great thing? Because we both think you are, obviously.
Yeah.
So for me, I'll give a little self-disclosure. So I've done public speaking on this in the past, but so I originally went down the medical path, and then life things happened and moved. And to finish my PA education, so for physician assistant, I would have had to start over because of my move, and I transferred. And I was like, love the field, don't love it enough to do it a second time. So I was like, okay, so what am I going to do? I have all this medical knowledge. I love working with people. I want to be in the helping profession. What do I do? And so then I found like clinical psych and health psych, and I'm like, this is it. I'm like, I get all this extra time to be with people. I get to be there more long term. I get to see them, you know, more frequently. There are things that I was just really excited about. Like I'm very lucky. I get spoiled. I get 45 minutes with a patient instead of 15 to 20. So like things like that, like I get to have all that time where, and it works well being integrated in primary care because I have the time to dive deeper and get the history and the context that primary care physicians and providers don't have time to get. So then I can relay that back to the providers. Mm-hmm. But personally, beyond that, I had some of my own life experiences and traumas with like domestic violence that kind of, and I had my own experience with therapy that I was like, wow, this is amazing. This can actually truly be life-changing. And from there, I was like, soon as I was given the opportunity to change paths, even though it wasn't in that moment what I was, you know, thinking about doing, and it kind of completely shifted, I think I ended up exactly where I was meant to be, because I was like, now I get to do this for other people and help them with, you know, help them with the traumas, help them with these, you know, symptoms, help them navigate life and just have a better quality of life simply through talking, behavioral changes, changing your mindset. And then it's very rewarding when you get to that point.
Yeah. I have two questions, but the first one is, so you brought up COVID, and I think one of the things that I saw as a big change during COVID was because we went to kind of a virtual format for a lot of things, we saw a lot of online virtual therapy. And, so interested, one, in your thoughts on that. And then two, you know, if I'm looking at a virtual option, maybe because there's no one in my area or it's easier for me given my travel, what should I be looking for? Because to your point, there are a lot of different types of therapy that exist.
Yes. So in terms of the pros and cons of virtual. So I think one of the things is what you just said, like one of the pros, you can have access to a broader range of providers, right? Mm-hmm. So before COVID, therapy could not be done virtually. And I don't know, you know, not everybody knows that. It was something that didn't exist. Like teletherapy was not a thing, did not exist at all. There was already some movement with medical world, but there was none for therapy. And so that was a big shift because it had to be done. And depending on your setting, very few mental health providers were considered essential workers and allowed to go into work. And so because of that, like that really shifted it because everybody still needed the support. They probably needed it more than ever, but it wasn't necessarily that they were allowed to go and do their work. As far as the cons, I think it, depending on the patient's preference, as well as the provider, some people are able to connect more easily virtually than others. So some people may feel kind of distant or not be able to really like connect through a camera, because I mean, if you think about how much of you see right now, you have no idea what the rest of my body's doing. You can't tell if I'm bouncing my leg up and down and I'm actually nervous. You can't tell if I'm, you know, wringing my hands or if I'm like picking at my skin. You can't see any of that. And as a mental health provider, that is important information for me to know, because they won't necessarily know that they're anxious. But I can say, hey, see you doing a couple of these things. What's that about? Is it just like too much energy? Are we maybe feeling a little anxious and not just aware of it? Right. So I can kind of get more information. So for me, what I've chosen to do is I really try to do all my intakes in person. So I at least see them once. If after that they want to switch to virtual, awesome. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But at least if I have one, I feel like I can get a pretty good picture of the person. And then I have less chance of missing some important detail that I wouldn't necessarily be able to catch virtually. However, we live in a world where there is an extreme shortage of providers. So if it is seeing someone virtually versus nothing, then virtually it is, right? And sometimes that is necessary. Because, you know, in terms of licenses, the only limitation is they have to be licensed. You have to be seen by somebody licensed in this, your state where you're doing your session. Mm-hmm. So like theoretically for either, you know, depending where you're at, New York and Pennsylvania, as long as that provider is licensed, they don't have to be in your hometown. And part of that goes along with knowing the local resources. So that's another part of the issue that can come up, is that if I see somebody, you know, virtually that lives in New York City, I don't know anything about the resources. Like, I don't have great detail of like, you should go to this hospital or this thing out there. So can I help them find it? Can I give them resources that will help them figure out? Yes. So like I said, in terms of it being better than nothing, absolutely. But also it's not always the right decision. And some people are completely shut down because you also have to deal with technology, and that's not everybody's favorite. So there's lots of things that can be barriers, but I think this has overall opened the world of mental health because people can pop on another lunch hour at work and not have to come. So I have several people that I see virtually who would not be able to get therapy if I didn't see them virtually. So it just kind of depends. I think it's just about figuring out what's right for each individual.
Yeah. Great points.
Then you had said to your second question, can you recap? Because
I think you covered
it all. Did I catch it?
Okay. Yeah. All right. What I was going to ask, and I want to see if Steve has other questions first, because I was going to ask you to take us out on a breathing or a grounding technique that is fast, because I don't think we learn those. You know, what does that mean? But Steve, do you have other questions first?
I think that's the best way to end it. I'm all for it.
So there's a whole bunch of variety of them. So the quickest one would be to literally do 3 deep breaths. Mm-hmm. And so that is literally in through your nose, out through your mouth. So this is one of the best ones, depending on where you're at. You can actually lift your arms to help expand your diaphragm. We want to make sure it's a belly breath. So we don't want to be, because that's not actually expanding our diaphragm. To expand our diaphragm, a lot of people, even like when you're teaching kids, you'll have them put their hand on their belly and you tell them to push their belly out as they're inhaling. So you want to go. So you're actually moving that hand out and in. And then in terms of in through the nose, out through the mouth, if you're working with kiddos, as well as just for ourselves, think of it as I'm going to sniff the flower. I'm blowing out the candle. So you're sniffing the flower. You want to hold it for a little bit, and then you're blowing out the candle. And everybody's duration of holding it is going to vary. They usually say somewhere from like 4 to 6 seconds. So you can do it as a square where you're like inhale for 4, hold for 4, exhale, hold. So those are some super quick, easy ones that you can do. So I'll let you guys kind of do a couple. We'll do a couple deep breaths and I'll give you a grounding one to kind of talk through too. Ready? So we're going to go through our nose. Hold and exhale through your mouth. 2 more. So we're going to in through our nose. Hold and exhale through your mouth. We'll do 1 more. And if you want to try it with your arms this time, you can. So you're going to inhale through your nose. And exhale through your mouth. So that's just a super, super easy way to ground our nervous system. So this is a form of grounding in a way, because how do you feel?
Like, I don't have a whole afternoon of meetings.
See, there you go. So it kind of just calms us. It puts us in the present moment because you're focusing on the physical feeling. You're either focusing on that hand moving. You're focusing on really fully expanding your diaphragm and those lungs to get a full deep breath. On exhaling it fully, you're focused on so many of those things. It brings us into the present moment. But also, slow breathing is the opposite of anxiety, right? Because what do we do when we're anxious? We hyperventilate, right? We just did the complete opposite of that, right? Slow, deep breaths. So it's going to just ground our nervous system and put us at a lower baseline so that we're not going into the next thing up here. We're going in more down here. Mm-hmm. Another nice, very common grounding one would be 5-4-3-2-1. So have either of you ever heard of that before?
No.
Okay. So this is based on the senses. So the very first, so it goes through each of the senses. I won't go through all of them. But just for an example, the first sense is things you can see, right? Because it's usually what we can see the most. So five things that you can see. So you kind of look around and you just pick things. However, a tendency tends to be when people are reading this, like they say, I see the wall, I see a clock, I see a door, I see a this, and they just list them. How much do you think that brain work that actually takes?
Very little.
Right? Yeah. I can rattle off a bunch of words very quickly. It takes me 5 seconds and I feel the same. So I tell people you want to like engage in the item. So you want to actually like kind of engage with it. So you can say like, I see an umbrella and it's leaning in the corner. It is a longer one. So I'm guessing it's probably a golf umbrella. It has a long, slender, tapered black handle. And then it's white and black checkers on the actual fabric, right? That is engaging with the item. One caution I give is I always tell people you want to pick something either positive or neutral. You don't want to pick like, oh, look at all the dishes in the sink. There are so many of them. And look at the food out of that. Like, that's not helpful. So we want to pick something that's positive or neutral. But the nice thing and the reason this is grounding, right, is it's forcing us to focus on the present. Yeah. So one of the way that, you know, the general concept tends to be is depression tends to be negative thoughts and feelings about the past. Anxiety tends to be, you know, negative thoughts and feelings about the future. So if we can bring ourselves into the present moment, that alone can help us manage those things a little bit more, because then we can also access our rational side of our brain rather than the emotional.
Wow. Well, that was fantastic. I learned a ton. You know, the goal of this episode was to get people to understand OCD, just a touch more, even if it's just a little bit. And I have to say, I learned a lot. So it was much more than a little bit.
Happy to hear it. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. And thanks. We'd love to have you on again for a future episode.
Yeah,
absolutely. Sounds good.
Well, Steve, what a great show we had today. Thanks to Dr. Zapp for joining us and really showing us that our concerns are valid. And if we have symptoms that maybe seem are too much for us, it's worth talking to our healthcare team to see if there are things, processes, not always just medications, that can help us. And I also think we got some great tips on relaxation, some things that we can all practice in our day-to-day lives. We may be practicing right now to help us keep a clear mind and kind of decrease some of those anxieties that we have in day-to-day life.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's great for everyone to give it a try at home. And as always, if you don't have a chance to reach out to your primary care team or your provider that you know and in your hometown or home city, but you're experiencing an issue that maybe just can't wait, or if you're having any suicidal thoughts, we always encourage you with any mental health issue or illness that you may have going on to please reach out to the National 988 hotline. You can call or text, that's 988, and there will be somebody there to help you 24/7. For any other health concerns that you might have, any other day-to-day tips about any topic that runs the gamut, we encourage you to reach out to guthrie.org/engage so we can hopefully help you live a healthier lifestyle.